Well, good morning, everyone. Welcome to KEI. It's not too hot in here yet. Glad to see you all here. I don't know why on earth you wanted to come this morning. My name is Nicole Finneman, and we are about to get started, but I do have a few logistical announcements to make quickly. You have hopefully been enjoying our lovely little slideshow here. Myself and Ambassador Pritchard have also recently returned from North Korea, and these are photos from our trip. Every picture that you saw outside of Pyongyang or outside of what looked like a city was in fact in the Yongbyon area. And we were able to take pictures up to about a mile away from the actual nuclear compound. So that's the surrounding community. This, of course, is a factory in Pyongyang, and I'll be changing this in a second. We are going to run things like this today. In a moment, the gentleman will come in. Ambassador Pritchard will make some introductory remarks, and then Dr. Hecker will give his presentation from the lectern. He does have some slides he'll be using. Following that, we've asked Dr. Hecker and Mr. Bob Carlin to take a seat on stage and answer your questions. Ambassador Pritchard will moderate that. Now, I do need to mention something about the Q&A. Because of a high demand for the audio feed today and a desire to make it good, we will only be using one designated Q&A mic so that we can get it right. So you'll have to get Ambassador Pritchard's attention, and you will have to wait for the microphone. Not only that, we're going to need you to speak very clearly when you introduce yourself and loudly. So wanted to make sure... give you the heads up on that, and we will allow as much time as possible for Q&A afterwards. Now, another thing, given the high volume of cameras, we would just ask for our audience's polite respect of that and not walk in front of the cameras if at all possible. The other thing I'd like to mention is that given the events of last night, but the nature of this program not being about North Korea and South Korea's exchange of artillery fire, we have just organized a Q&A following this event with Ambassador Pritchard and Dr. Peck Hak-soon of the Sejong Institute. You're here somewhere. There you are, sir. Thank you. Have agreed to stay at immediately following this event on stage and answer questions about the events that occurred just now between North and South Korea. All right, well, that I'm going to beckon them, and we're going to get things started, and I just wanted to thank you all for being here, and hope you enjoy the program. And now it's quiet. They're not ready somehow.
This reminds me when I was with Secretary Albright and we went into the May 5th auditorium and I thought it was completely empty until Kim Jong-il walked in and everybody roared, but it was absolutely silent. What do you do? You know, is nobody breathing here? It's okay. I'm Jack Pritchard, the president of the Korea Economic Institute. It is our great pleasure to host you for this event. As you can see by the turnout, and the interest, this is, in fact, a very significant event. What I'd like to do, just tell you how we're going to run things. I'm going to give you a little bit of preparation in terms of the trip that Nicole Finneman and I went on 1 week prior to Dr. Hecker and Bob Carlin's trip. There's a few interesting points that we'll make and that will segue into Dr. Hecker's presentation. He'll come up, make his presentation, and then we'll have just a little bit of a shuffle as we bring some chairs up so Bob Carlin can join him up here for the Q&A. So with that, let me just begin. On the 2nd of November, Nicole Finneman and I went to North Korea. We were there from the 2nd to the 6th of November. We had asked to go see the facilities at Yongbyon, not really to look at the new construction that was underway, but just to try to figure out what was going on in the intervening time since the last inspectors were there, and I think in April of 2009. When we got there, we were briefed by the General Bureau of Atomic Energy's Safeguards Division Director. And he gave us a little bit of preview of what was going on at Yon Bian, which really was not much. But we began a discussion about the Fuel Fabrication Center. And in that discussion, I came to learn that the enrichment facilities that we were looking for, uranium enrichment facilities, were in fact at Yon Bian. The reaction that I got when I got back to Pyongyang and we began to talk with the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, they were surprised that we were told that. And the ensuing discussion, the points that we made with them was, you are headed down a path that will put you in the same light as the Iranians. You have said that you're building a light water reactor for peaceful nuclear energy. There is a uranium enrichment facility that you say is for low enrichment uranium for creating a nuclear fuel for this light water reactor. But given our history and the background that you've displayed, no one's going to believe you. And if you take a look at what has happened with the Iranians, you are on the path for additional sanctions, international condemnation. But if it is exactly what you say, there is no reason in the world you should not allow people in to take a look at this. Invite the IAEA inspectors back in to take a look at this, or at the very least, and I don't mean to be the very least, you should show Dr. Hecker these facilities. They sat back and essentially were very thoughtful and said, well, we'll consider what you said. I had no idea what they were going to do, but when we came out of Pyongyang, we went to Beijing. I contacted Dr. Hecker, who was just arriving, and he and I had a conversation about what Ms. Fenneman and I had observed, what we believed that would better prepare him to focus on the enrichment facilities and the light water reactor. So with that as background, I'd like to introduce Dr. Siegfried Hecker, who is a professor at Stanford University's CSAC facility.
Thank you, Jack, and thank you, ladies and gentlemen. As I look out, I must say the crowd is just a little bit older than the usual Stanford student crowd. Professor Bill Perry, also known as former Secretary of Defense, and I teach a class on the role of technology in national security, and we touch on places like North Korea, Iran, and others. So if you don't mind, I'm going to take a little bit of the style of my class and try to put this trip in the proper perspective. In other words, not just to give you a travel log. Let's see, I got to make sure I turn this on. Not just to give you a travel log, but actually try to put the whole thing in perspective, particularly since this trip seems to have gathered a lot of attention. So as Jack mentioned, I'm out at Stanford, and to put it in perspective, let me first say this visit didn't just come out of the blue, that all of a sudden they would invite me to come to Yon Bian. This was my seventh visit to North Korea. I was taken there initially by Professor John Lewis, who's been doing track two with the North Koreans since 1986. And the first time was in 2004, and that's when they showed me the plutonium. That's when they first actually said, look, we have the plutonium. The message was, because they had a message in each of these trips, the message was, we have the bomb, and your government ought to pay some attention. We were back in 2005. The message that time was, this is Vice Minister Kim Gae-gwan talking to John Lewis just before the September 19th agreement, is, look, we're ready for an agreement, but we want an LWR, a light water reactor. Indeed, the agreement was signed a month later. In 2006, I'm shown here with the director of the Yongbyon nuclear complex, and the message at that time, this was 3 weeks after the nuclear test, the test worked and we're filled with pride. That managed to get the Bush administration to actually engage the North Koreans in a bilateral discussion, and in 2007, there was the February first step agreement signed. And I was in there in August of 2007, and the message was, look, could you tell those skeptics in the West, we've actually turned the reactor off, it's off, and they turned it off in July of 2007. In 2008, they had begun the disablement process. And by the way, that's me in the what we call anti-sea clothing to make sure that you protect yourself against potential contamination. And what I was doing was to be able to attest the fact that the disablement was actually serious. But disablement meant sort of taking it and putting it somewhere, but being able to put it back, which they did in 2009, because in my visit in 2009, they essentially announced, we are going to leave the six-party talks, we're going to do a missile launch. And of course, the rest is history. So that's where we were. And this is the current visit. As Jack had indicated, he had given me the heads up because he went to the facility that's shown on the left, and that is, instead of erecting another cooling tower, which is what some people suspected, they actually told us we will convert our center to an LWR and pilot enrichment facility. And they said, well, no one believed us when we announced this in 2009, which they did, including you, Dr. Hecker, and it's true. So let me read, this is the only reading that I will do, let me read for you the essence of what the chief technical officer told us in the guest house when we came and visited this November 12th. He said, in the 80s and 90s, we agreed to give up our reactors for LWRs, 2,000 megawatts electric by 2003. That was the Kido arrangement. In the early 1990s, we built a 50 and a 200 megawatt reactor of the gas graphite design. Now they have become ruined concrete structures and iron scrap. And I can attest to that for the 50 megawatt reactor. We've not been able to contribute to the national demand for electricity, so we decided to make a new start. For us to survive, we decided to build our own LWR. On April 15, 2009, the Foreign Ministry stated that we will proceed on our own light water reactor fuel cycle. We have completed the discharge of the 5 megawatt electric spent fuel, we processed it, and delivered it to the military for weaponization. That's what was done in 2009 when they walked away from the agreement. Our nuclear program has not proceeded as expected. We have not delivered electricity and thus have impacted the economic condition of our country. We will use our economic resources to solve the electricity problem. We're willing to proceed with the six-party talks and the September 19th agreement, but we cannot wait for a positive agreement. We're trying our best to solve our own problems. We will convert our center to an LWR and pilot enrichment facility. It is a high priority to develop uranium enrichment. We will have some difficulties with this, but we're proceeding with the LWR fuel cycle. We've designated a site, and also for the LWR and uranium enrichment, it is the first stage, so it's first priority. The construction is completed, the facility is operational. You will be the first to see this facility. We showed the LWR construction site to the Korea Economic Institute delegation headed by Jack Pritchard and his colleagues. So that's what they told us. And I wanted to read you that because that's very different from much of the hype. And so what I'm going to do, and by the way, that's included in the report that I wrote, which is available on the CSAC website. But I wanted to read it to put it in context, is that they are serious about building an LWR. But first, let me actually go back and review the status of their plutonium program, because that's what concerned me the most at the beginning and is still what concerns me the most today. It's a 5-megawatt reactor, which is shown, actually the site is shown on the right. On the lower is a photo we took in 2008. It's shut down. It's in standby. There's no new plutonium being produced. There's no cooling tower. The fresh fuel to load is not ready. Reprocessing facilities in standby, we saw no action. There's no plutonium in the pipeline for that facility. The fuel fabrication facility, they're starting to convert it to LWR fuel. The 50-megawatt reactor is indeed iron scrap and a concrete mass. The 200, we didn't see. It's at a different site, but it's also not salvageable. So that gets me back to the plutonium inventory I've made in the past, and that is 24 to 42 kilograms is the general estimate, and that's enough for, let's say, 4 to 8 bombs. They've claimed that they've weaponized all of that. So the main thing I want you to take away from this, if they really wanted to increase their weapons program and their nuclear arsenal, they would restart or rebuild some of these facilities. That's the quickest, surest way. They've tested twice. They know how to build a plutonium bomb. That's where they would go. So here they took us to the light water reactor construction site. And the circle that you see is the concrete containment shell going up. It's right next to the 5-megawatt reactor. So the motivation for LWR, since most people say they can't build one, is they've been after an LWR for a long time. They started the reactor building with gas graphite reactors. The best way to put that is those reactors are great for bombs, they're not so good for electricity. They built them for both, but they never finished the two big ones. The same direction that the UK and France began with, but they've switched to light water reactors also, as has most of the rest of the world. But in the 1980s, they realized that they had problems making nuclear electricity, so they tried to get two light water reactors from the Soviets, and they had an agreement, but of course that was dashed by the end of the Soviet Union. In 1994, they tried the US instead, and that's the agreed framework, where we were going to build them, again, 2,000 megawatt reactors. That remains unfulfilled with the dissolution of the agreed framework in Kyoto. And my colleague Bob Carlin can answer any of those questions. And then my own experience in August 2005, as I just mentioned, at dinner over in Pyongyang, Vice Minister Kim Gae-kwan said, no LWR, no deal, no joint statement. And so the U.S. managed to get enough of an LWR in there saying at an appropriate time it will be considered. In 2007, he told John Lewis and myself that, look, we want an LWR. If you don't trust us, you can operate it. And by the way, we won't enrich and we won't reprocess if you're concerned about proliferation. In 2009, as you just heard from what I read, they said, we'll do it alone. They also said, you know, we don't know how to build a light water reactor. We've never done it before. So instead of building a 1,000 megawatt reactor, they're going to build a 25 to 30 megawatt electric reactor. And that actually makes very good sense. That's exactly the way they did it with the gas graphite. So when I before said, I don't think they can build a light water reactor, I was talking about a 1,000 megawatt reactor. And they can't build one now, and they're not going to try. They're going to build a small one. And Vice Minister Kim Gae-kwan made it very clear that that reactor is important not just for practical economic reasons, but for symbolic reasons. They want to get something out of their nuclear program. So here are the details on the light water reactor. And, you know, I'm a technical guy, so you'll have to forgive some of the numbers. You'll hear the term 100 megawatts. But that refers to the thermal output. You know, in the end, a reactor is nothing more than a water boiler. You just use the nuclear reaction to boil water. And then you make steam, and you have the steam drive a generator, which gives you electricity. And the conversion from the heat to the electricity brings down the power from 100. They actually never told me it was 25 to 30. They just said one typically gets 30% efficiency. The reinforced concrete containment shell was going up. 22 meters in diameter, 40 meters high is what they told us it would be, about 7 meters down. They need a pressure vessel, and that's one of the toughest parts of building a reactor. Again, there's no way today they could build a pressure vessel, actually do the forging of such a huge structure in North Korea for 1,000 megawatt, but they said they can do it for the 25 to 30. The electrical generators, they said it would be for the local communities, and we have to link it to our national grid. You have to change the fuel from uranium metal to uranium oxide. That's why the chief technical person told us, look, we haven't done this. We'll probably have some difficulties, but we're going to do it. They have to put in a different cladding than the metal reactors. Again, they're going to have to learn that. And the fuel has to be enriched. And the typical enrichment, they told us, 3.5% of the fissile uranium isotope 235. And they said the target of completion is 2012, which is the target of completion for essentially every major project because it's the centenary of Kim Il-sung's birthday. So I think that's unrealistic. However, the claim that they're going to build a light water reactor, which a lot of people have just dismissed, is credible. Okay, so what are the concerns with them building a light water reactor? Quite frankly, my biggest concern is safety. You know, we in this country lost the capacity to do things like, you know, do reinforced concrete for big structures like the nuclear power reactors. And we have to go back and relearn that because we haven't built one for such a long time. They're going to build a small one, but it's really important that that containment structure can actually hold a potential accident. And the role of the regulatory agencies is absolutely crucial in assuring the safety of a nuclear power reactor. I asked them, they said they have one. It didn't make me feel really very comfortable. It's a new design. They have a new team working on that. What I mean by INPO and WANO is the Institute for Nuclear Power Operators and the World Association of Nuclear Operators. After the Three Mile Island accident and Chernobyl accident, the rest of the world's nuclear power operators got together and said, look, we've got to do something. We've got to learn from each other as to how to run these things safely. And the safety record of the world's nuclear reactors has been absolutely outstanding since that time. Maybe we ought to have North Korea as part of a WANO to make sure that they construct that reactor safely. People will say you can make plutonium. Well, it turns out if you feed uranium into a reactor and you make you get neutrons going, you make plutonium. All reactors make it. But that's not the way you'd make good bomb-grade plutonium. It makes some, but you can do a lot better with the existing reactors that they have. And besides that, if they decide to make plutonium with this reactor, I think that's sufficiently readily detected. But it requires enrichment. For a light water reactor, you do just a tiny bit. You know, the natural uranium is 0.7%. Uranium-235, you have to get up to 3.5%. A bomb is 80 to 90% or so. So the facility itself, then, as we get to uranium enrichment, they said they started construction in April 2009. That's when the U.S. technical team and the international inspectors were expelled after they did their missile launch and had a U.N. Security Council statement condemning that. They said they completed it just a few days before our visit. I'm not sure exactly what completed means. Reconstruction and renovation of Building 4. I'm going to show you an overhead. They took a previous building that I was actually in, and they renovated it. This building is 120 meters long by something like 18 meters wide. It looked new from the outside. We couldn't see the roof, but I'm going to show you in a minute. It's blue. And then there are several other new buildings visible at the fuel fabrication site because you need some of the feed material for the uranium enrichment. Okay, this is the overhead for the fuel fabrication facility. Now, if you were to look for something new, what would you look for? The blue roof. It's like putting a bullseye on top of their facility. So people say they build a secret facility, for heaven's sakes. All you got to do is look at the fuel fabrication facility. It's got a blue roof. It says, here I am. And again, it's more than 100 meters long. And so what we did, we walked into that fuel fabrication facility. By this time, they had told us that they had done centrifuges. So the best that I thought that they could do before was, you know, their news reports, and actually President Musharraf in his book says that AQ Khan sold them 24 centrifuges. 20 of what are called the P1 and 4 of the P2s. So I thought we'd see, you know, a couple of dozen of these centrifuges in an old workshop. We walked up to the second floor, looked through the windows, and I'll show you that in a minute. But first, sorry, the comparison of 2010 with July 2009. And you can see that the blue roof, which is shown under the black dividing line where I show fuel rod fabrication, that was building 4. So obviously things have changed and it's very obvious. And this is what was in building 4 when I was there in 2008. They were disabling it. But then this is what we saw when we looked in. Now they didn't let us take any photos and they took no photos, so I had to doctor up a photo. So I took a photo from the Piketon, Ohio centrifuge plant. And I wiped out some of the extraneous centrifuges. But what we saw was 3 centrifuge lines that looked like that. My jaw just dropped. I was stunned to see what looked like hundreds and hundreds of centrifuges lined up two each at three different locations. It was just stunning. In a clean facility, modern facility, looking down, I said, oh my God, they actually did what they said they were going to do. Then they told us the rest of the story, the 2,000 centrifuges in a 100-meter hall. Centrifuges, I guess they were 6 feet high, 8-inch diameter. I think I was right on the 8-inch diameter. They're probably less than 6 foot high. They claimed to have steel rotors. Now, to the techies, that's very important because that makes it a P2. Actually, they called it an iron alloy, an alloy with iron. But the stuff that's used is a very high-strength steel that's called Mariging steel. And so they're P2s. The P2s, you know, stands for Pakistani 2. They copied them from the German 2, which HQ Khan stole from the Urenco facility years ago. Most important number on here, again, this is a techie number, is 8,000 kilograms swoos per year. That's the capacity of what they can enrich. So what that means, they can make 2 tons of LEU, that is low-enriched uranium, a year, and that's enough for that little reactor. So it's sized just right for the reactor. They claim to be operating and making low-enriched uranium. We could not attest to that. You know, we didn't hear any noises. There were people running around, you know, in the control room. There were all kinds of displays up. It looked like there were things going on, but in the end, we couldn't tell because we were isolated from the halls, you know, by windows. A very modern control room, you know, with the latest flat panel screens and LEDs for readouts. I'll show you in a minute, very different from what we've seen at all the other facilities. So the capacity is consistent with an LWR. I just show you another one here. This is the Urenco centrifuge cascade because the plumbing in the one on the right is actually closer to what we saw than the one on the left. And the one on the left now isn't doctored up. That's actually the Piketon plant. So again, you know, don't say that these are the North Korean centrifuges, but they looked something like the ones on the left. So the control room, again, we have no pictures, but we went to Kim Il-sung University E-Lab, you know, that you see there on your left. And you can see the students there with the flat panels, the computers. By the way, these were HP. Now, it turns out HP is not, you know, on the export. I mean, those screens are not on the export control. And the computers are not on the export control, at least those that we saw at Kim Il-sung. On the right, you see what the reactor control room looked like of the 5-megawatt reactor. This is our 2004 picture. So the control room looked more like Kim Il-sung University. So what's the problem with uranium enrichment? Well, the problem is the dual-use problem. And that is you need to enrich for light water reactors. If you're in good international standing as a country, it's easy to get someone to do that for you. Kazakhstan is going to make fuel for a lot of the Chinese reactors. They're going to make the fuel, but the enrichment is going to be done in Russia. Actually, initially at the Russian International facility, but that didn't work out, so they're going to the main Russian facility. So if North Korea would be in good standing, they could get their fuel enriched someplace else. But they now feel they have to do it all themselves. So the problem is the same technology, the same equipment, can be used to make highly enriched uranium. You just do some replumbing, and then what you have is what I call the Iran problem. So Iran has developed the capacity and the capability to enrich, and we worry about the fact that they also can go to highly enriched uranium. So how do you do that? You either kick inspectors out of your facility, and of course now we don't have any in Yongbyon, and we should, by the way, as far as I'm concerned. Or you have another covert facility someplace. The problem with that, you know, for the HEU, for any uranium enrichment, it's a small footprint, it's a small signature, it's not like a reactor, it would be very difficult to detect. So the 2,000 centrifuge cascades, as I said, they can make 2 tons of reactor fuel, or they can make, and these are all estimates, 40 kilograms of bomb-grade highly enriched uranium if they replumb or have another facility like that someplace. So that's enough for one or two bombs. Other people will tell you more, but let's just say that's close enough. So how does this change the whole security dynamic then? So unlike what has been reported so far in some of the newspapers, in my opinion, not much for what they currently showed us for the current capacity. If you're going to build a bomb or more bombs, restart the plutonium facility. All modern nuclear arsenals use plutonium. The Pakistanis, which have used highly enriched uranium, are in the process of making plutonium to switch over. Essentially, everyone has switched from uranium to plutonium. But once demonstrated, then they can duplicate this capability anywhere. And that's the concern. It's difficult to detect. However, they can't just go and build these ad nauseum because they're limited by the materials and the equipment. You need high-strength steel, high-strength aluminum, components, ring magnets, frequency converters, bearings, vacuum valves, molecular pumps, you know, all of this technical stuff. And we generally feel that they probably can't make that themselves, but I'm becoming very careful as to saying what they can and cannot do. So the indigenous manufacturing capability, we just don't know. However, if they indeed duplicate this facility at several other places, make a lot of highly enriched uranium, that then changes the security dynamics, not what they have now. They could become more like Pakistan, you know, have 50 to 60 weapons or whatever that number is instead of a handful. But however, still more sophisticated bombs really require nuclear testing for the uranium, or they require plutonium and more testing. And plutonium is indeed superior. So the question I'm sure that you will ask, and I've asked myself many times since that day on November 12th, how did they get this? Now, what we saw, you don't build overnight. You don't start in April of 2009. It requires many years of development, manufacture, and testing. It's most likely decades of R&D, procurement, and training. And I've said before, I'm absolutely convinced they have a uranium enrichment program. But I thought it was at the R&D level. They've done better. I would call this, you know, high pilot scale or sort of small industrial scale enrichment. The other reason we know they have it is they're the, you know, the news stories about highly enriched uranium particles on items that North Korea gave the United States, a sample of aluminum alloy some years ago, and then actually the production records, copies of the production records. And then there was a question that somebody shipped uranium hexafluoride, which you only use if you're going to enrich, to Libya back in the 2000 or so timescale. And the general feeling is that it was most likely North Korea. So the current system is likely built and tested outside of Yongbyon. And unlike the original reactors, I believe these centrifuges do require help. Now, the best articles that I've seen on this is David Albright and Paul Brannon of ICES, the Institute for Science and International Security, just published a month or so ago. They lay out this extensive cooperation with Pakistan, you know, going back to 1993, including training of North Korean people in the KRL, as it's called, the Khan Research Laboratory. And then they supplied them a starter kit, and then they also lay out the complex web of procurement, which includes the high-strength aluminum from Russia and Germany. And then my concern all along has been the possibility of connections to Iran. But quite frankly, what we saw, 2,000 centrifuges, these 8,000 kilogram SWU, that's about twice what Iran has done so far. So I'm not sure that I would go to Iran if I were North Korea. It might in the future be the other way around. So nevertheless, I worry about cooperation with Iran. Okay, I'm getting close to the end, but again, another question you'll have is, why did they show us this and why now? And the real answer is, I don't know. And Bob Carlin, I don't think, knows, so he'll tell you later. And my colleague John Lewis doesn't know. But we can speculate. So, the one thing that's for sure, they're serious about building an LWR, and a reactor under construction would have been visible soon, only another couple of weeks, and all the analysts from the overheads would have said, oh, they're building a reactor. And they were heading off the spin because most likelihood some people would have spun that up into a new plutonium-producing reactor, and that increases the threat enormously. So they headed it off. And it's a way of admitting the uranium enrichment program with a cover story. You know, it's needed for an LWR. It's the same cover story that Iran has. I think the other message was, look, don't underestimate us. We're not about to come to our knees. And Bob can talk more about that because he's been there many more times than I have. But just my quick observation, you know, the seven times I've been there, each time I've gone there, the country looks a little bit better off. And it doesn't look like the economy is going. But if any of you have suggestions, you know, we're ready to listen. So let me just show you then to wind it up with a few photographs. Just to, you know, usually you see photographs of people starving in North Korea. Hardly anybody ever shows you what they can do. This is a wire factory we saw in 2009. It's one of the most modern wire factories I've ever seen anywhere. They make wire electrical cables. Now, this is a garment textile factory that we visited this time. It was just great, very, very modern, good. This is the Pyongyang University of Music. When they decide to do something, they can build it fast and they can build it beautiful. This time we were in that hall because Poland was celebrating its 92nd anniversary of its independence, and they had a couple of Polish artists and a North Korean artist that actually played the piano and played violin, and it was just beautiful. By the way, you know, Poland has an embassy there, as do many other countries, but not the United States. This is a swimming pool at Kim Il-sung University. By the way, I'm going to introduce him. That guy on the right is none other than Bob Carlin. For public effect, this is, for those of you who've been there, the concrete pyramid, 20 years unfinished. 2009, some of the glass going up. This time it was just stunning. You look down the street, you see this thing. They don't have it occupied yet. We'd like to stay there, but I think we'll wait a while. Last year they had phone booths, and we said, wow, they now have phone booths, you know, but they don't have cell phones. Well, now they have cell phones. You know, one of the European people there stationed for one of the embassies, 350,000 cell phones in North Korea. They control, you know, and very closely, but they have cell phones. So, what do we do now? I think the most important thing is really understand what the capabilities are. Don't hype the threat, but treat it seriously. And then remember the Perry process. For those of you who were here in the 1990s, you know, we had major panic after they launched a missile over Japan in 1998. President Clinton sent former Secretary of Defense Bill Perry to try to reevaluate the policy and the entire dynamics of the Korean Peninsula. And what he said was, deal with North Korea as it is, not the way we'd like it to be. I think we need to do a policy review. We haven't done one since 2000. Certainly stay the course on denuclearization and to contain the threat. But for now, the most important thing is don't let the threat grow, especially in light of the altercation that just happened over there in the sea again. So for me, to contain the nuclear threat is what I call the three no's. In return, you got to give them one yes. The three no's are no more bombs, no better bombs, and no export. The no more bombs is no more plutonium. That right now, that's what they're doing, no more plutonium. Also, on the highly enriched uranium, let's get people in there to make sure that they're actually making low enriched rather than high enriched as best as we can. No better bombs means no testing. Can't make better bombs significantly better without testing. No export. That's really the issue of Pakistan, Burma, Iran, and so forth. And then the yes is, we're not going to get anything, and this started off, you have to address the fundamentals of North Korea's insecurity. And that's one thing that my colleagues John Lewis and Bob Carlin have taught me, and their op-ed piece in the Washington Post yesterday really underscores the need for a policy review, and you have to address the fundamentals. So with that, I was going to say I'm going to get off stage, but what I'll do is just switch, but I'm going to introduce my colleague Bob Carlin with one more aspect. No, leave the lights down for just a second because this is a great photograph. By the way, all those photographs are ones that I took with my camera. They wouldn't let me take them in their facility. Okay, this is a great shot because they always tell you there are no lights in Pyongyang. There's no heat, you know, around. There's more heat this time. There are more lights this time. There are even lights at night. Ooh. Oh, you... Somebody took it off. Oh, my favorite slide. Let me... With that introduction, I give you Bob Carlin.
Scroll down and see if it's
Jack, yeah, let's see. I don't see a mouse here. Okay. the last slide. For some reason, the last slide was left off. Yeah, it's just it's left off. Okay.
My apologies.
Yeah. Okay, I'm sorry. At any rate, the last slide had Bob Carlin's silhouette in front of one of the lit-up cultural houses, and it was just beautiful. So the buildings are lit up. So with that, ladies and gentlemen, I'll give you back to Jack Pritchard, and then Bob Carlin will join me.
Yeah. So you're going to be in this chair here, so as soon as they put it down, you can stand up. Okay. So, let's double check to make sure your mic's on. All right, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to have a microphone. It's going to go down the center row. For those of you that would like to ask questions, if you would please identify yourself and very clearly ask your question. So who's first here? Okay, beige jacket.
Jung Min Kang, visiting scholar site, Johns Hopkins. Sik, thank you for your presentation. Did you have a chance to ask North Korean about the manpower and the power supply for operation of enrichment plant?
Manpower and power supply for the enrichment facility.
Mm-hmm. So the first of all, in terms of power supply, we saw nothing because we were not. I saw nothing inside. We did not get down to the first floor, so we saw no power supplies. In terms of manpower. We met with the chief process engineer who runs the facility, and then we saw a number of people in the operating room. They took us to the control room and then what they call the recovery room. And so there were operators in there, you know, half a dozen or so people, but I did not, or we did not get to talk to any of them. And in terms of actually asking about their credentials, I did not ask about the enrichment people's credentials. I did ask about the reactor designers, and what we were told there is that it's a new team of designers, and they're being mentored by the people who built the old gas graphite reactors.
Okay, next, please. Here on the side, we're going to pass the mic down. Just please wait when it gets to you.
Gerald Epstein, with the American Association for the Advancement of Science. So I'm wondering if the ALEO program is a cover-up and they intend to do weapons on that route. You said that nuclear power, all other nuclear powers actually prefer plutonium. But it was also my understanding it's harder to actually technically weaponize the plutonium to get it to work with the precision you want. And there was some speculation, at least after the first test, that it didn't hit the yield that they desired. Might there be a reason they would want to work on uranium because of the weaponization being easier, or is that not a significant factor?
Yeah, one certainly cannot rule out that, and I, in fact, I mean, I would say there certainly would be looking at uranium designs also, and particularly, you know, what we know is that AQCON gave a uranium implosion design to the Libyans, and there's at least speculation that he may have also given those to Iran and to North Korea. Now, the uranium, the implosion, by the way, for plutonium, what you have to do is take a ball of plutonium, sort of the size of a grapefruit, put explosive around it, set it off in a number of points and implode it, which you know well. For highly enriched uranium, you can actually just make a very simple device by putting it in a gun tube and shooting two halves together. But uranium, you can also make the implosion device, and that's the device that AQ Khan gave the drawings to Libya. So if the North Koreans have that drawing, they would have at least some basis for doing a uranium implosion device. I would imagine that they have exercised their design capabilities that way. But we have no indication as whether the second test was a plutonium test or a highly enriched uranium test. What they told me when I was there in November of 2006, that the first one was plutonium, and what I was told later on also, no, I'm sorry, that was related to the first test only, that the first test was plutonium. And we do not know what the second test was, But my speculation is that it was plutonium.
First against the wall here, and then standing up against the wall. Bear with us on this microphone because it's also linked to the cameras.
Thank you, Josh Rogan, Foreign Policy. I'm sorry if you mentioned this before, but could you talk more?
If you could make sure you speak up. I have difficulties hearing in a large
Sorry
room.
About that. Can you hear me?
Go ahead.
Could you speak a little bit more about what the North Koreans said about possible return to negotiations? You know, you said that they were still willing to engage in six-party talks, but did they give you any more detail than that? What did they have to say about the Obama administration's diplomatic efforts? What did they have to say about China? Talk a little bit more about the political things that you were hearing. Thank you.
See, so I'm just a scientist. So I turn to my colleague who understands the policy much better.
I'm his escape route on these sorts of questions. I would say that, surprisingly, they talked a lot less this time about the diplomatic route. It's not that they were suggesting it didn't exist, but the thrust of the conversations was not really in that direction. They did say that they were going to have nuclear weapons for a long time, and we'd better get used to it, unless and until we satisfied, as Sig said, we satisfied their concerns about their security, that if that weren't addressed, they were not going to give up their nuclear weapons. I can't recall that they really said very much, too much about six-party talks. They gave us the obligatory statements that they were prepared to go back and to honor the September 2005 statement. They did say that if we wanted to get back to the situation prior to April 2009, there were a couple of things that we could do. And one of them really was to reaffirm the sorts of statements that had been made when the dialogue was really on firm ground in October 2000. It's pretty interesting to me that they did that, and I think it's pretty important, not because of the substance of the statements dating from October 2000, but because of the symbolism of those. Those came during a period when it was the culmination of a very long, involved series of negotiations. And those statements stood at the top of that, when we, in fact, had an element of trust. We had had thousands of hours of contact. We understood what we had accomplished and what remained to be accomplished. But most of all, we recognized the existence of North Korea as a system as it was. In effect, those statements put on paper the recommendation that Dr. Perry had made in his review, that if we were going to make progress with North Korea, we couldn't insist that they change first, but we were going to have to deal with them as they were.
I would imagine Jack.
The week prior, Nicole and I also talked with First Vice Minister Kim Gae-gwan and Ambassador Lee Gun on this issue. We did talk about six-party talks. And as Bob had indicated, they referred back to when we go back to six-party talks, we're interested in going back to a period of time prior to April 2009. Now, with us, they weren't going back 10 years to the statements that Bob is indicating, but they're talking about the pre-UN Security Council presidential statement that followed their launch of a missile on the 5th of April. What they also talked about was a little bizarre reordering of priorities. They talked about what was embedded in the 19 September 2005 joint statement, in which, from their point of view, we agreed to discuss a peace treaty, and we agreed to talk about the normalization between countries, and we agreed to talk about compensation for North Korea's whatever they're going to do. What they didn't talk about was the denuclearization aspect of that. My response to them is, you got that exactly wrong in the priority. So if you take a look at that statement, it talks about denuclearization. Oh, by the way, in a separate event, we can talk about a peace regime at some appropriate time. So that's what they're focused on. Kim Gae-gwan also said, we understand from the Chinese that you, the United States, Japan, and South Korea are not ready to return to six-party talks. So we, the North Koreans, will not be hasty in pushing for six-party talks. Okay.
So, Jack, if I just may add one thing on the technical side. Having the enrichment capacity that they showed us, even if it's just what we saw, although clearly they got it ready someplace else, certainly complicates the technical part of getting back to the six-party talk. Before, I could have written the script, you know, of what to do to contain the plutonium program. Now you can't write the script the same way anymore, because if they're reluctant to give up the bomb, they're not going to give up the centrifuge capability, because they can say it's done for the light water reactor, and we're building a light water reactor. So one will have to change the dynamics in some fashion to accommodate the fact that they are enriching and building a light water reactor, you know, unless we want to go change it back to what we did in prior years.
Okay, thank you. Son, up here to Jill. One up. Thank you.
Thank you. Jill Doherty from CNN. Professor Hecker, I just wanted to make sure I understand what you were saying. You obviously thought that they had come very far very fast, and you were very impressed. How do you think they did that? Were they did they get the information that you talked about from AQCon and then build upon that, or is there somebody else out there specifically helping them? Do you ascribe to the theory that there are other secret sites that may be doing the very same thing? And then also, is it possible to ask Professor Carlin about the implications of what happened today? Is he the proper person to talk to about that?
Or you can ask him, but okay. We'll do that later as well.
Oh, that is later. Okay.
Sure.
Well, then maybe we just leave it at that. Thank you.
So the real answer is, I don't know. But as I said, we can speculate. So first of all, they need a lot of material, which is very difficult for them to make. And it's material that even Pakistan and Iran can't make today. And they've managed to import that from other places. So over the years, if you look at their procurement history, they've apparently been able to import a number of important materials, like this high-strength steel and the aluminum alloys, and also some of the components that I mentioned. So they must have had those already and have probably been procuring them for the last 10 years or so. So you need that. Then second, you don't just put up a centrifuge facility, you know, and start even the reconstructing of the building in April 2009 and have it spin away, you know, by November of 2010. You know, the Iranians, it took them 20 years to procure all this stuff and be able to make this work. And so what they must have done, again, this is speculation, is they did it somewhere else. They had a number of, and it must have been more than a few centrifuges, did it someplace else, got it all perfected, and then brought it onto the Yongbyon site. Even that, to do that, you still need to train your people. And I think that's where, you know, if you read the Albright-Brannon piece, they had them in Pakistan. So it's the combination of all of those things.
Let me check your mic one more time here and make sure it's getting green on both sides. It is. Okay.
See, I have one more mic here.
Up,
so there's
up
one.
Front. Second. Right here. Right to your right. You want?
Okay. I see.
You're good now.
No, you get red.
You're good now.
No, now you're red. One more. Well, it says on, but we've got a red button, so yeah, that's fine. Bear with us. Okay, you got it? All right.
Thank you. I'm Haksun Pak from Sejong Institute in Korea. I'm a North Korean analyst. And I think it is very significant for North Koreans to mention the importance of returning to the October 2000 joint communique between the United States and South Korea, because it was a comprehensive resolution of the so-called Korean problems, if you will, North Korean problems, if you will. Anyway, but Bob, I have a question for you. Dr. Hacker talked about the absolute need to accept North Korea as it is, just, Bill Perry pointed out in his review at the, previously. And what do you sense about Washington, D.C., about this? Americans are ready to accept that kind of absolute need to take care of North Koreans' sense of insecurity to solve the nuclear issue?
Haksun, you know I'm not a Washington analyst. It's much easier to analyze North Korea than it is Washington. All I can say is I hope that people now recognize that the policies that they've been following could stand some reevaluation. That a development like this suggests that at the very least we need major refinement, and maybe we even need to go back to basics. Are they ready? I honestly don't know. Sorry.
Chris Nelson.
Jackie,
go ahead.
Just wanted to make one comment, because I put the words up there, deal with it as it is rather than what we would like it to be. So, of course, people would say, as it is, does that mean you accept them having nuclear weapons? They have said that they will honor the September 19th agreement, under the right circumstances. So as I put on my visual, is you start with the fact that there will be denuclearization. But the fact is they've had the bomb at least since 2003. So they've had the bomb for 7 years. And even though we've said they can't have the bomb, but they've had the bomb. And so the issue is one, is clearly you have to start that the end goal is denuclearization.
Chris?
Thanks very much. Chris Nelson, the Nelson Report. Doctor, you were quite clear in your report when you released it that you don't see this as a weapon program right now, and you were quite critical of the administration, various officials, basically just right off the bat saying this is an HEU operation of some kind. What is your advice to the administration and how they talk about this? Should they stop calling it an HEU, or does that dramatize the point that you did make, that it does have that potential if they keep going? And the other theme that kept coming up yesterday when we were all making our phone calls is, boy, this really puts the Chinese on the spot. Does it? Do you sense Chinese involvement in the plant or knowledge of it? What's your advice on what do we say to China, and how should China react to this?
So let me turn on the China question. I'm going to turn to Bob. No? on the first issue of what you were concerned about, and that is what one says to the administration, let me address more the newspaper, or at least some of the news coverage. I chose my words carefully and to say, look, take the HEU program. I mean, take the uranium enrichment program, and if they make HEU, that's serious. So take it serious, but don't hype it. And I laid out what, in my opinion, the risks are associated with the enrichment program, that they can go to HEU. With HEU, you can get bombs. And if you make a lot of it, then that could change, just the size of their arsenal. But don't hype it. And to get from what I saw to a hydrogen bomb, I mean, that's just an incredible step. I don't believe that in any way, shape, or form.
Okay. Lee Jae-hyun from Seoul National University.
I'm sorry, the China question?
The China question. I don't think we've really heard them declare themselves on that. And until they do, we're not going to have much of a sense of what their view is. The Chinese have never said the North Koreans can't have a peaceful nuclear program to produce electricity. And since the North Koreans say that's the purpose of the program, I suspect that's going to be where the bulk of their position is for a while. Can I use this for...
Sure.
I can't resist this. You know, this is very ironic. The North Koreans are building an LWR, and they have an enrichment facility. And this raises all sorts of problems, as Sig suggested, concerns about will they reprocess the fuel from the LWR? Will they change from low enrichment to high enrichment? Will they be able to make uranium bombs, et cetera, et cetera? We've been here before, as a matter of fact, but as a matter of fact, we were going to build them the LWR, and we were going to have complete control of the fuel. We were going to ship the fuel in. We were going to take the fuel out. For reasons not altogether clear, we decided we didn't want to do that. And so we scrapped that program. And I just, this is...
Boy, he's going to do this because I couldn't get the photo of him up.
This is an actual keto cap. This is all that remains of that several billion dollars expended on this. And it doesn't hurt to remind ourselves that we had a bite at this apple once upon a time. And the fact that the North Koreans are doing it now, it's not our fault, but the more we wait on this problem, the more things develop and make it more complicated for us to address it.
Let me, before the next question, do a couple of things along this line. First of all, Bob, you said you didn't know why, but whether it is correct or not, you may go back to October of 2002. The United States suspected that North Korea was creating a second route to a nuclear weapon by highly enriched uranium. There was a confrontation in which we accused the North Koreans of this. Coming back from that trip to Pyongyang, the Bush administration decided that, yes, the North Koreans were doing this. They were in violation in the spirit, or perhaps even the technical letter of the law, the 1994 agreed framework. And at that point, the Bush administration ceased the provision of heavy fuel oil to North Korea. That led to a cascading of events that created what we now call the second nuclear crisis that really began in December and January, late 2002 and 2003. Now, with regard to the Chinese, this is anecdotal, but after we left, Ms. Fenneman and I left Pyongyang, we went to Beijing, and we met with some very prominent and senior Chinese academics, not government officials. And we posed to them the question of what is China going to do if North Korea continues with some very serious provocative behavior? Now, we've got a couple here that you may suggest that qualify that. The revelation of this low-enriched uranium facility, or more importantly, what occurred yesterday or last night, and that was the artillery barrage. We got a somewhat surprising answer from the Chinese. This is not a Chinese government official, but the Chinese said the Chinese will react even milder the next time. They are very concerned about the stability and the long-term survivability of the regime. This is from a Chinese academic. Okay, next. Go ahead.
Let me just cut in.
Chris, don't ask any more questions. On the
China part, and again, putting the technical things in perspective, as far as the Chinese technical people, they've continued to underestimate the capabilities of the North Koreans. You know, I've dealt with the Chinese for a long, long time. They didn't think they could get the reactor back up in 2003, and they did. They didn't think they could reprocess the plutonium, and they did. They didn't think they could build a light water reactor, they're building one. And enrichment, they said, not at all. And of course, I underestimated that also, but the Chinese do underestimate. In terms of they're taking the technical to the policy, this current situation of having an enrichment facility and building a light water reactor, it's going to be very difficult for the Chinese to say they can't do this, because the Chinese have said all along they can do, you know, the sovereign right is to develop civilian nuclear energy.
Okay, now the question.
TJ Han from Seoul National University. My question goes to Dr. Hecker, that you mentioned there should have been a research and development of light water reactor in North Korea far before than they announced it. Does it go prior to Kido project? And also you mentioned that it is completely new design. How do you know it is a completely new design? And like what aspect that this light water reactor is different from what we have seen from the in the world?
So the completely new that I mentioned was not the design, but the designers. Okay, so there's a new design team, a younger generation. I asked how young, and they said in their 40s. They were trained at North Korean universities and have been at Yongbyon and learning the nuclear trade, and they're now going to design this. And so it's not a completely new design. The light water reactor designs are out there in the world, all over. This is a very small version. Remember, 25 megawatts instead of 1,000 megawatt. So this is tiny, tiny. But it's five times bigger in terms of electricity than the one they currently have, this gas graphite, which is not very good for electricity. So in terms of them having had interest before, the interest before was always to get it from somebody else. As late as 2008, in February, I spoke with their technical people and actually asked them, so do you have your people over at the Kido project? And the answer was no. And so the light water indigenous capabilities, somewhere they gave up. And they started to actually the design of the reactor. What we found in the past in the gas graphite reactors and in the reprocessing facility, they have typically patterned that after someone else's. In terms of the reactor, it was the so-called Calderhall reactor in the UK. In terms of the reprocessing facility, it was a reprocessing facility in Belgium. They built them themselves, but they were patterned. Interestingly enough, and I have this in my report, so I'll say it here, when my colleague John Lewis asked, so are these, you know, P1s or P2s? And he wouldn't answer the P1 or P2, but he said they're modeled after those at Almelo, which is in the Netherlands, that's Urenco, and then he said Rokashomura. So again, so they have some patterns out there. They look at those, they study them very carefully, then they bring them in and they do it indigenously. Oh, that's my view.
That reminds me. At the LWR site, on the construction equipment, they had selected a excavator. I don't know if this was deliberate or not, but anyway, it was Hitachi, which I think they were delighted to be able to show that they had some sort of Japanese support for this, you know, project. Too bad we didn't have a camera, but we couldn't take it.
As long as you're plugging Hitachi, the elevators that run in the Koryo Hotel are also Hitachi. All right, let's go in the back of the room all the way. Mark Mannion, go all the way back to your right. He's got his hand up.
Hi, Mark Mannion from the Congressional Research Service. Dr. Hecker, I'm wondering if you talked a little bit about how this could complicate a return to the negotiations, because the North Koreans could claim, you know, somewhat credibly that they need these centrifuges for electricity. And I'm wondering if you could also talk about how it complicates the verification process that would need to be, that we would want, and also the value of inspectors, because it would seem it would reduce the value added that inspectors would have. You know, previously, if they were there, they could sort of keep a close eye on the plutonium facilities. But now, because as you said in your report and here, you know, we don't know what's going on in other parts of the country, and it's highly unlikely, as we saw 2 years ago, that the North Koreans would allow inspectors to roam around the country to conduct on-site random inspections. So could you talk about how this complicates the whole problem of verification and inspections?
So the biggest problem on the verification it would not be that facility. It's very simple, certainly with an on-site presence, to know whether it's LEU or HEU. It's actually simple with just having some equipment, monitoring equipment installed, or going back and taking swipes around the place if you're allowed access. So for that facility, it would be simple. If we got access to the facility at least periodically, we could say whether it's LEU or HEU. The complication is, from what we saw, as I said before, I believe they must have moved it in from someplace else. They must have had a whole bunch of centrifuges spinning someplace else to be able to do it so quickly. And we're not going to find those places without having some presence in the country. And that's going to be very difficult. So I think in terms of looking at the future, then it makes this verification issue as to whether they have nothing or if they should start getting rid of what they have, it makes zero really difficult. Before, we could assume, well, they don't have enrichment, so it's not so important to find it, or if they have a mom-and-pop shop. But now that we saw these halls, it changes the picture. So that's my concern.
Okay. Right next to you.
Huang from Yonhap News Agency. Dr. Hecker, you said the Chinese underestimate North Korea. And I think that's the same to American officials, because they are uncertain about North Korea's enrichment capabilities. They showed you the facilities, the plant, and they risked being targeted by a surgical strike. So the theory is that they don't care about being targeted because they have many more. What do you think?
So could you help me out on that track?
Yeah. What he's suggesting is that, like the Chinese, perhaps the American officials have underestimated the North Koreans. The fact that they have shown you this facility, which obviously could be used by a military surgical strike, that they don't think that that the Americans would do that. It's relatively safe from that.
Yeah. So the Chinese underestimated, and. Let's say I underestimated them on the uranium enrichment, on the basis of what we've seen. Now, it turns out in 2002, it looks like the Americans may have overestimated what they could do in the 2002 timeframe. So what one has to do is, I've always said, is we know the least about the enrichment, and I wish we could get a better handle. So they gave us the better handle by inviting us in.
Okay, over to all the way in the back, the lady with her hand up.
Hi, I'm Laurel Beman with Voice of America. My question is, this revelation to you and to the world, can this be related at all to succession announcements, in your view?
I still didn't quite. Could you just repeat in the microphone?
Yeah, the question was, could this be related to the succession issue going on in North Korea now, the fact that they revealed this facility to you?
Mr. Carlin.
Sure,
it could be. I am not a fan of single explanation rationale for North Korean action. And you've got to be very careful not to choose the last headline that you read and assume that's behind what the North Koreans are doing. If what Sig says, not if it's true, Sig said it, it's true, they've been at this for a long time. So the program itself is not related to the succession. So the very narrow question is, well, was this, this time frame, November 13th, related. And it could equally be they had a target of opportunity. SIG was visiting, and they needed to show it to an expert. There aren't a lot of experts going into Yongbyon. And so that may have been what drove it as well. Though there may be, a little bit of the succession thing in there.